Good afternoon, everyone. Bonjour tout le monde.
C'est bon.
Welcome, all of you, to this afternoon's session. Just double-checking. Can you hear me well at the back? You're fine? Thank you. My name is Marie Wilson, and I am one of the three commissioners of Canada's Indian Residential School Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Before that, for 25 years, a former radio and television reporter and producer, both at the regional and national level, and a longtime broadcast manager and broadcast trainer. And so I have spent a lot of my professional life, the majority of my professional life, in print radio and television media, probing from our professional point of view the contribution as a journalist that I might make to our society and to the public service of our society. And I say that as kind of an opening comment in introducing myself, because I know that in my experience as a journalist, the vast majority of my colleagues were like-minded and like-hearted in that regard, wanting to make a difference, wanting to do good work, wanting to fulfill their responsibilities in a good way, and wanting to feel like what they did mattered. I know that over the course of my years, I saw dramatic changes in the technology of the tools that we use to do our trade, in the speed with which we were able to communicate with each other, with our central assignment desks, with newsmakers, with the breadth to which we were able to share and expose our reports and our reportage, and with the degree of sophistication and expectation with which consumers of news in whatever format expected to know about it, right now, and in fact often, and I include the politicians in all of this, to know about it in the way, in the means, and in the time frame that they wished, whether or not it was enough time for you to do full justice to your craft. We've seen a move from, for the young ones, you'll find this comical, but, you know, I actually remember telex tapes and pre-emails and pre-computers and five-part print paper, and I'm just telling you this stuff for comic effect, really. It's not particularly relevant to today, except to say that tools, in a very important way, have come to define what we can do and how we can do it. And I think, in a really critical way, often risking compromising the quality and the worth of what we are able to do. To use that old phrase, the tail wagging the dog sometimes, so that everything becomes reaction and not enough time for proactive reflection and proactive analysis. And I think that that's one of the challenges that we face in the world of media. The other thing I think that has changed things completely is a complete scattering of our notion of who are we serving? Who is our target audience? Who is using what tool today? Because I know that in my own family and in my own household, how I consume news is very different from how my 20-year-old children consume news. I came here this morning to find out that in the informal media of today, I am now a dance star, it turns out, because there were images of me circulated last night dancing with the young scholars. I haven't seen them yet, but various other people in the world have. I'm saying that news can outpace the newsmakers almost, and it's kind of funny, but it's also quite profound. We barely have time to swallow our thoughts before we're expected to have still more, and to have advanced them. And then the other question that comes to my mind is, who are the news tellers? So much news is generated these days by informal mechanisms, whether it's YouTube or whether it's email chains or whether it's blogs or whatever. Anyone Any one of you here can be a self-appointed reporter today and go out and post things, and I'm not saying that's bad. I'm saying it raises very legitimate questions about, I won't say professional qualifications because I'm not one who necessarily thinks that's the measure of everything. But I will say that it does raise questions and about legitimacy of source, knowing who the source is, knowing what is a reliable source, what is a self-serving source. And I think it leads to a lot of confusion and destabilization about knowing what's real and what is spin. I think, too, we have seen with the media and as a result of all of those electronic changes, an incredible shift in even the understanding of what is newsworthy, where celebrity culture and where we know the names of movie stars, dogs, and children more than we know the names of our own prime minister and local chiefs, where we think that politics is the same as news. And that if it happens to come out of the mouth of a politician, it is automatically newsworthy. We can get into that trap if we lose our ability to stand back and reflect with enough proper time to do so. These are all things that are very shifting, changing forces. The last point I want to make, which in many ways I think is the most important one, is what are all those things that never make the news, that so rarely make the news? Reference was made this morning to the 582 dead or missing Aboriginal women in Canada. And I don't know if some of you saw columns that I saw this morning. And one of the columns was really about there were rallies all over Canada on Monday, and why was it not in any of the national newspapers that happened? What does it take for it to become newsworthy, and who decides that? In my years of broadcast and journalism training, one of the questions that we used to ask, and I'm sure you're all very aware with the who, what, where, when, and why stuff, but the important question that I used to always challenge journalists who were still new in their trade to consider is, what is happening, why is it happening, so what, and who cares? And those last two questions take you in a different place. Because if you cannot convey that story in such a way that it has an impact, or that people can understand quickly in our very busy lives what the impact might be, and why they should care, and being the many often and not just the few, then I think we've sold short the power and potential of the journalist and the journalist's product, and we've underserved the audiences that we set out to serve so well. So those are just some of my initial thoughts leading into today's session. We have a wonderful panel here. I wish I could say I knew them all personally and were friends with them all, but I have never met most of them before last night, and some only at this very table. You have a very full CV on each of them, and I'm not going to waste our limited time by going through all of that. I will draw your attention to page 14 in the program, which outlines the speakers. And just for your ease, because I know you can't see these signs really well at the back, at least I couldn't this morning, I want to tell you that I'm going to go in the order that they're printed in the book, so you can follow in that way. You'll know who's speaking. And I want to point out as well that we have Sputnik Kalambi, who's with us as well, and she's in the addendum, so you don't see her listed on that panel. The rest are in alphabetical order, so I'm going to invite Sputnik to speak after Colette. So she'll be the number two speaker. All right? So I would ask each of our panelists to please take... we have quite a bit of time, and we have a break in the middle, but we have many speakers as well, to take 10 minutes or so to offer what they want to say as first remarks. And in the beginning, if they might just also take a moment to introduce themselves with one or two key points that they think would be helpful to you to understand where they're coming from. Thank you. If I could start with Colette.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Well, when I started my career, I first reported on migrants, and at that time it was the first generation of migrants. After that, I became more busy with African issues, but still, I'm interested in those items, and I have to see how the situation has changed. For instance, in the city where I live, it's Brussels. It has now 300,000 citizens from North African descent on a total population of 1,100,000 inhabitants. Most of them are the second and third generation. So it's a big change when I compare with 30 years before. And despite their Belgian citizenship, those people still face many problems, housing problems, poor level of education, particularly for the men. Girls sometimes are doing better. And also tensions between communities related to international conflicts. But in Brussels, it's particular. The discrimination is very subtle. Brussels, being the capital of a two-language country, French and Flemish, speaking those two languages, those two national languages, is compulsory for most of the jobs. And most of the young people from migrant origin in Brussels speak only French. And this explains why the level of unemployment is so high in the town, between 20% and 30%, while there are a lot of commuters, more than 250,000 each day come from other parts of the country to work in Brussels. But that kind of reflections regarding the migrants, unfortunately, you don't find them so much in the press. The press is focusing more on a political approach, discussion on the status of Brussels, lack of resources of the local authorities, problems of finance, uncertain future of the capital in a country that faces a political crisis. And in reality, the youth from migrant origin, they face also hidden discrimination. For instance, on the recruitment forms of an interim agency, three letters were written in a corner of the letter, BBB, that means blanc, bleu, belge, white, blue, Belgian. It's a name of a cow that's very famous for the quality of its meat, but it means also, it's sort of a code to say it means true Belgian. And this agency was condemned on trial, but many people have been discriminated before this fraud was discovered. And very few newspapers have covered this story, although it's a very symptomatic one. There is also discrimination in housing, in bars, in dancing, but the mainstream media in Belgium, as in the neighboring countries, don't focus so much on those issues as such. They lack examples, they don't spend much time reporting on those social issues, and they don't like to go and to report in so-called hot neighborhoods. And for instance, they cover more what they call violent incidents happening in the neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, where migrants are the majority. And this coverage creates a distorted image of Brussels, like a distorted image of Paris, maybe. City where other people coming from the countryside for other towns feel insecure. And it's very strange to know that in Belgium, the same as in France, very few information is given about the daily life of those groups from migrant origin. And I remember that in France, for instance, where the banlieue were burning, a blog was opened. It was opened by a Swiss journalist, a very famous name. It's the Bondy blog, the name of this neighborhood. And while you could see that the war correspondents, the reporters always ready to go to Afghanistan, to Iraq, were not interested in taking the metro for two stations and spending some time in the hot banlieue. You have the same thing in Belgium. And so it creates a sort of discrepancy in the coverage. Riots, violent incidents received maximal attention, big pictures, much more than the description of the everyday difficulties that the minorities are facing. The same happened with the veil. In France, in Belgium, we have very few cases of women wearing the burqa or what we call the integral veil. And we have to note also that some of those women are from Belgium or from French origin, and they have chosen freely this form of Islam. But the debate in the press, in the op-ed pages, it's much larger and passionate than the phenomenon itself. And it has led both countries, France and Belgium, to vote a law banning the burqa in public places, because this integral veil has become the symbol of a radical Islam. In Belgium, April 29 this year, the Chamber has adopted a law banishing the use of any clothes masking the face partly or entirely. And the Senate has still to pass the law, but the debate is not closed. In fact, we face a double exclusion. Muslim migrants from the second or third generation develop a sort of radicalism. They are connected with their country of origin through satellites, to TV and so. But there is also within the public an extremist reaction towards the Muslim community as a whole. And for instance, now in Belgium, some journalists, they cannot write hate stories in their paper, but they have created internet sites with a common password, which is vigilance. And when you see this word vigilance citoyenne, citizens, vigilance, it's always a warning against Islam, that we must be aware of the danger of radical Islam means to our societies, to our cultures. And on those sites, any kind of abuses, any kind of incidents are extensively reported, and this creates a general feeling of insecurity. But so on internet, it's very difficult to control the message. Also, in the dialogue pages in the newspaper, newspapers are very tied by the law. You cannot write hate stories in the print. But sometimes we open the debate, and people just write and send stories. There is a dialogue, and there. We must be very very aware of the hate messages. They go very very fast, and sometimes the colleagues that cannot even stop those messages to be published in the forums on internet of the newspapers. But I think that if there are scenes in the press, in this coverage of diversity, I think that it's more seen by omission, by lack of appropriate of broader coverage, than really scenes of blatant racism and discrimination. But there are a lot of subjects that are covered, but only as a fait divers or just without very deep analysis. For instance, problems that we are facing, there are many. We have in Belgium, we put children in close children from asylum seekers into closed centers, which are like prisons. And the press is reporting on this. There are also very violent expulsions of migrants. And we reported on this only when it becomes a fait divers, not a matter of a problem of a society. There is another thing that's very bad, but it's reporting on a political term. It's what we call in Flemish the wound code, which means that everybody who wants to rent a house in the Flemish part of Belgium has to prove that it has links with the community. It has been at school, or they have a job there, or they speak the language. It's a very subtle way of discriminating the people who want to live there. But despite of that, the press is more focusing of the exclusion on political terms, because they say it's excluding the French-speaking people to settle in Flemish parts of the country, and it's not directed against migrants, while to me it's a clear discrimination about everybody. But in the press, we have a very clear, the legislation is very clear. We had the first law repressing racism and discrimination was adopted in 1980. And every citizen who feels a victim of mistreatment due to its origin, religion or color may appeal to for justice. And in 2007, this law has even been reviewed and extended. In 1993, the Center for Equality of Chances was created as an official body monitoring discrimination, offering its support to the victims, including legal support, providing advice, studies, recommendations. And each year, an average of 4,000 cases are submitted to the service of this center, who employs 100 persons, including 50 lawyers. That means that everybody who feels discriminated in the press may immediately appeal to this center who is intervening. But this center is not supported by everybody. In Flanders, for instance, three political parties, including the main one, have put on their program the suppression of the center. And the center deals with the media and can be compared with, in France, la Haute Autorité de lutte contre les discriminations, which can be compared with the Belgian center with the capacity of testifying in court. And more than the law, more than the center itself, the media have now their own watchdogs. In the editorial chart of every main newspaper, it is clearly stated that it is forbidden to promote any kind of discrimination or racism. In Belgium, too, last year, Conseil National de Déontologie, National Council of Deontology, was founded, whose members are journalists, editors, independent lawyers. And this council, being a new institution, I cannot give you any statistic of the cases submitted to them. But anyone who feels mistreated by the press has the possibility to complain, and the blame can be sent to the media and to the author of the article. And it's a very powerful pressure, because it affects the reputation of the author. It's a sort of peer review among the journalists. And for instance, in my own newspaper, a sub-editor published once a headline writing, "Hutus have raped women in Kivu." And a complaint was submitted to the Conseil of Deontology, because it was a sort of generalization, and the board of editors of the paper had to explain why they did this mistake, why and what are the constraints we are facing when we make the titles of the story. And let me go now to the veil. In Belgium, France and Italy, the debate on the veil has received more media coverage than any other issue regarding minorities. And my feeling is that the media have overreacted to this. And in Belgium, a recent public poll has noted that 71% of the people who were asked the question about the veil responded that they are not bothered by what we call the convictional signs. So for 71% of the people, it doesn't mean any problem. But despite of that, there is an extensive media coverage on this issue. And the media is unjustly focusing on the burqa. But the question of the veil has risen in different sectors, public administration, education, and public places. In public places, only the burqa poses problem, not so much for security reasons, but we consider that's a breach of the law that's obliged every person to be recognizable and to have possibilities of regular communication with and social contacts. as the veil, it has now become an issue in public services. We are supposed to be neutral. While France is laic, Belgium is neutral. And any conventional signs are equally forbidden. But Belgium being a very pragmatic country, a distinction has been made between front door jobs where civil servants are in contact with the public or backdoor jobs, generally backdoor less qualified. And there is also a tolerance as front door jobs in neighborhoods where migrants are in significant number. There are other issues less covered by the press, but still under debate. It is the special treatment or workers or consumers are asking due to their beliefs. For instance, special leave for religious holidays, time to pray during the working day, a special place for worship. Here again, pragmatism has prevailed. Inquiries have proven that longer leaves were mostly asked in July or August, when migrants from North Africa want to go back home for longer periods, more than any religious reason. Places for worship in the companies, private companies, have been called places to relax or to rest, because many employers are convinced that the mere existence of a place to worship could be considered as a sort of pressure to other workers, to those who don't want to pray during the working hours. And another issue is the halal food, but now it's less an issue than a business. Halal food is widely available in the supermarkets, and migrants have opened their own shops, and in school, halal or veg food can be ordered. And the widest coverage in Belgium has been given very passionate to the use of the veil in schools. In Belgium, a mix of cowardice and pragmatism has until now prevented the legislator to adopt laws on this issue. It is the organizing power of the school that has to decide. That means the director of the school. So they can decide from case to case. And last year, it has been a very hot issue, largely covered by the press, and particularly in Antwerp. Myself, I went to the school, I reported on the issue when the director of one of the best elite schools of Antwerp decided to change the rule and to prohibit the veil in the Athenaeum. Before, the veil, as other conventional signs, were permitted, but no students were allowed to refuse attendance to some classes like swimming, gym, and physics. And the director suddenly changed her mind when she noted, that is what she said, that the pedagogical project of the Athenaeum was in danger. Because of its permissiveness, the school was attracting a majority of Muslim students, and the girls who were wearing the veil were exerting a pressure on their colleagues, and the director considered that this was depriving the other students of their freedom of not wearing the veil. And finally, she decided to forbid this veil inside the school, and a special room with a large mirror was there installed in the entrance of the school, where girls could take their time to unveil and before entering. And the result is that some of the girls stepped out the school. There was really an outcry, large media coverage, many TV debates on this, but after maybe too much, but after a few weeks, the girls came back and things went back to normal, because it was a very good school with a very tolerant approach in general. And another thing is to note is that 10 years ago, what we would call the popular newspapers tended to focus on criminalizing the minorities in order to please their supposed mainstream readers. They put the emphasis on crime, on violence, on riots. But now the readership has changed, and more readers, they come from migrant origin. So this so-called popular press must attract a new readership and give stories interesting them. And so they they avoid any racism or discrimination. And the last thing I want to tell is that now the newspapers, the press itself, try to promote what we would call good practices. This is hiring journalists from minorities, although no veil is allowed on screen on TV, and in the print, in the paper press, even journalists wearing the veil are not allowed to keep it outside of the newsroom. And some initiatives tend also to encourage good practices. For instance, the King Baudouin Foundation, which is a private foundation created and funded by the late King of Belgium, this foundation is supporting projects of young reporters who want to go to report and to stay for a certain amount of time in the country of origin of migrant communities. And this project has allowed several young journalists to spend time in Morocco, Turkey, or other countries to report on those countries, on the culture, and so with the idea to create bridges between the communities of migrants and the reporting of those young journalists. There are several projects like that. There is also a newly created fund for journalism that also finances reporting in the countries of origin of migrants in order to also to build bridges. And so the last word as a conclusion, the press is not breaching the law because the law is very strict. The journalists know very well how far they can go and what are the rules. But the press is not spontaneously building bridges. They do when they are funded, we are pushed by special initiatives. They don't build bridges by themselves. There are a lot of items that are not covered. And sometimes, by giving a too extensive coverage on very particular issues, like the use of the veil, the violence in poor neighborhoods, the press is giving a bias to the perception and even influence the law and the legislator who is addressing, for instance, the question of the veil, when, to me, there are more urgent issues that should be addressed before this one.
Thank you.
Merci beaucoup, Claudette. Colette, merci. You've raised some important points, and I'm not going to summarize them at all, but I think one of the ones that I heard loud and clear as an emerging one is the tension, too, in the context of this conference between freedom of expression and the tools that we have at our disposal that actually contribute to promoting either xenophobia or hatred sometimes, whether that's through the internet or by the absence of what we do not cover or those things that we stress extraordinarily. Thank you very much for your remarks. Our next presenter will be Sputnik Kalambi. She's originally from India, and as I say, her CV is there before you, but most recently has been working in Sierra Leone with UN Radio. Yes, I'm sorry. I'll share this.
Yeah, take this.
Thanks very much for giving me this opportunity to share my experiences and thoughts with you. Over the past 10 years, I've become a three-footed person. I've got one foot in India, one in Europe, and the third in Africa, where most of my recent experience has been. And it's been an interesting ride, living in three continents, moving from doing active journalism when I worked for Radio France International to training and media development in post-conflict situations. So my experience has been in Kosovo a few months after the NATO bombing, in Cote d'Ivoire, where I set up and ran the UN radio station, in Rwanda, where I worked with a private radio station, and most recently in Sierra Leone, where I helped with the transition to the country's first independent public broadcaster. And if it flies, it would be the second public broadcaster, independent public broadcaster in Africa after South Africa. the all different situations, yet the challenges were not dissimilar. In Kosovo, how to get young Albanian and Serb journalists to work together and produce impartial news and promote reconciliation. Trying to unify a divided land in Cote d'Ivoire through radio, ensuring that voices from the north, south and north were heard countrywide, again with a view to building peace. In Rwanda, where media are still in their infancy, attempting to set up a professional newsroom and encouraging reporters to think critically, which I think is the biggest challenge in almost all the countries I worked in. And finally, in Sierra Leone, where 10 years after the civil war, and despite the numerous media outlets, especially in print, it's clear that the so-called pluralism doesn't translate into much in terms of media fulfilling their role of imparting accurate, unbiased information, etc. And in all these cases, like media development in much of the world today, the impetus for better media, more professional, inclusive, impartial, and all the usual adjectives we use in this context comes from the North and the West, with the assumption that Western media are a repository for qualities lacking elsewhere, and that if only media in Africa and elsewhere in the global South functioned in the manner their richer counterparts do, many challenges could be resolved. But often lacking in this approach, I think, is a critical understanding of how media function in the West. Who owns the media? Whose voices are actually being heard? What is defined as news, and therefore worthy of coverage? The use of language, the biases that exist in Western media, Colette has just been talking about them. The ideological underpinnings of much of the mainstream media, I think, are rarely explored by those who help set the agenda of media development in what is still called the Third World. And these questions are crucial when it comes to discussing the coverage of human rights and what role the media should play. And again, the assumptions of what is democracy, freedom of expression, the limits to freedom of expression, development, progress. We live in a profoundly unequal world, and like Victor's justice, all these concepts are not as neutral as one would like us to have, us believe. And so it is with the human rights discourse too. And to quote Arundhati Roy, words like progress and development have become interchangeable with economic reform, deregulation and privatization. Freedom has come to mean choice. It has less to do with the human spirit than with different brands of deodorant. Market no longer means a place where you buy provisions. The market is a deterritorialized space where faceless corporations do business, including in buying and selling futures. Justice has come to mean human rights, and of those, as they say, a few will do. And to conclude the quote, to reclaim these stolen words, says Arundhati Roy, requires explanations that are too tedious for a world with a short attention span, and too expensive in an era where free speech has become unaffordable for the poor. This language heist, she says, may prove to be the keystone of our undoing. And it's true that not all human rights issues are considered equally sexy, so who decides which violations to cover and condemn? And then how is the problem presented? Through whose voices? How much context, socio-political and more importantly economic, is provided to understand what's really happening on the ground? I take the bread riots in Egypt a couple of years ago when world grain prices shot up thanks to speculators. And if one is to believe reports, Goldman Sachs also had a role to play in the wheat crisis. The media covered the story, but except on Al Jazeera, I think, there was very little context given to the bread riots. The police brutality was condemned, human rights organizations were given a chance to express their concern, but the link between angry people coming out on the streets in Cairo and decisions made in Wall Street boardrooms or elsewhere was barely, if at all, made. And if the context is not made available, what conclusions can the audience draw? And there are fears of a repeat scenario this year with the collapse of the Russian wheat harvest and rising grain prices once again fueled by financial speculators. And incidentally, are these people not guilty of human rights abuses? Speculating on the price of crucial life and death sources of staple food for thousands of millions of poor people? Even a marginal rise in the price of grain would have devastating effects on people who spend more than 70% of their income on food. And if there are bread riots again, there will be deaths, unlawful killings, repression, and God knows how many human rights abuses. Or to take another example, the systematic onslaught against the Roma community in France now, forced deportations, families broken up. If an entire community is thus targeted, what words should one use? Of course, there's been much protest and outrage. Some have even dared to compare this to Vichy France and how it resembles policies towards the Jews. And certainly many, even on the French right, are uncomfortable with what is happening and the image of France in the world. And it's almost laughable, if not tragic, to see French commentators dealing with this, oh, hell, look what's happening to our image. France being wrapped on the knuckles by the UN Human Rights Commission. Because, of course, such commissions exist only to condemn abuses in Africa and elsewhere, not in the First World. So mainstream coverage in France did reflect the criticism, especially from France's peers. But interestingly, no one thought of asking how this action was perceived in the rest of the world or to include other voices in the innumerable debates that have eaten up airspace. And again, for this Roma question, the economic and political background are indispensable to understanding what's happening and how one should deal with this. And the role of the media. Judging from opinion polls, a majority of French people apparently approve these tough measures against the Roma. So what should we do? If the majority approve patently condemnable actions against a minority, should the media just report this or question public perception, seek to influence it, change it? We all rightly condemn how the larger society went along with the extermination of people considered undesirable during the Second World War. But what have we done with the lessons learned, and have we really learned them? And if much of public perception is formed by the media, or at least informed by the media, then we have a huge responsibility. And I'll give you a personal example. Recently, I was in a boutique run by a Chinese woman, a small boutique with clothes, very cheap. I was with my daughter, who is totally Indo-European because her father is French, so she's much fairer than me. And she happened to cover her head that day, so it looks like a Roma. I mean, the Romans, after all, came from India all those thousands, hundreds of years ago. The next thing we were told, the Chinese woman asked us to leave. When I asked why, she said she was scared that she had her phone stolen 3 days ago. I assume she meant by Romas or people who look like Romas. And she finally ended up making a sort of apology. But what interested me was how she seemed to have swallowed the dominant political discourse on the Roma, that she did not see any connection between herself belonging to a minority immigrant community and the Roma, that she did not feel any sense of solidarity. So I come back to the question, I mean, how much responsibility lies with the media in helping form public opinion, in reflecting on identity and the perception of others, and how should that responsibility be addressed? I have more questions than answers, really, but I fear that when an entire community is thus stigmatized, the media has to be both provocateur and facilitator. Provocateur by asking the tough questions, providing the context, making the parallels, and facilitating an exchange of views to allow opposing viewpoints to engage with each other by attempting to provide or look for human ground. And economic issues underpin all human relations, and any discourse on human rights and their abuse has to take into consideration this dimension. In that issue, perhaps most issues are human rights issues: sanitation or the lack of, education or the lack of, maternal infant mortality, climate change, the use of biotechnology, investment decisions, as in the trade of conflict minerals, and now increasingly in Africa, the tendency to gobble up arable land and give it to foreign companies to develop biofuel. Even the high rate of road traffic deaths in India, for example, is a human rights issue. The poor are disproportionately affected. Of the millions who die on the roads each year, the vast majority is poor. In fact, one could even say the extent of a society's civilization can be judged by its regard for pedestrians' rights. It's not that these issues are not reported, but that they're insufficiently reported, and often without the proper context. The other problem is who gets to speak on these issues. Rarely does one hear from the real front line, those who live and die in the most precarious conditions. Despite all the hype of citizen journalism, I think the media landscape in most countries is still an insider story. I don't know how long I have. Well, to return to Africa, the challenges are huge. In all the countries I worked in, journalists are paid a pittance, when they're paid, that is. Working conditions are poor, there is an acute lack of resources, and yet they're expected now to work in a digital age. And by lack of resources, I don't just mean computers and recorders, but access to the phone, internet, tools that have become indispensable to the profession today. Poor salaries means journalists can be bribed to write or not write stories, to interview someone or not. So most private media, whether it's print or radio, are rarely independent. They might not serve the government of the day if they're not working for a state-controlled radio, but they're dancing to someone's tune. And the question of plurality in Ivory Coast and Sierra Leone, you have like something like 40 newspapers when you have a 70% illiteracy rate. So who reads these newspapers? Why are these newspapers published? Very often it's an excuse to collect advertising revenue. And very often the guys who run these radios or these, four-page newspapers have political links, and so they're pushing an agenda as well. And the journalists who work for them end up getting caught in this morass. And whether in Ivory Coast, Rwanda, or Sierra Leone, reporting the news generally is covering what the government says, starting with what the president says, what the government does, or simply making announcements. If it's an opposition outlet, there's criticism, but not necessarily a reasoned or a researched critique. Of course, there are notable exceptions, including those who've paid with their lives. But I think there are also those who, I think, make personal capital out of their profession or out of their opposition sometimes. And the other problem is, so you cover what the government says and you cover what the NGOs do. Every press conference called by an NGO, every workshop and seminar get front page coverage. And it's difficult to wean reporters away from this NGOization because they get a free meal or a per diem or transport money by attending the event. So they go and report, which means repeating the press release by the NGO in question. And basta, right down to the last bit of jargon. So you have stakeholders who are encouraged to benefit from this latest exercise in capacity building aimed at enhancing good governance. So nobody knows what this means. I mean, not the reporter and probably not the listener. So my challenge was to provoke these young journalists to relook at their copy, to understand the concepts they were touting. I mean, who are the stakeholders? Who are the beneficiaries? What exactly does the project entail, etc.? I mean, I could go on. I think maybe I will continue talking when we have the debate. But just to conclude, if by provocateur one means asking provocative questions, uncomfortable, challenging questions, perhaps upsetting the status quo, if it's based on research and also respect for social justice and a critical spirit, yes, I think the media should play the role of provocateur. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sputnik. And I think you've ended your session very well. Yes, the media should. And the other part of that is, to what extent is it? You've raised also very, very important questions about the importance of context and the importance of independence of media, as well as the, I think, very vital question, which I agree with, about criticism and or cynicism sometimes passing for or replacing researched critique, which is not the same thing at all. So thank you very much for your remarks. And we'll hear next from Anna Savorsian. And Anna is the Director of Human Rights Watch in Russia and can present herself beyond that, but by herself. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary. And thank you for so many people to come to this session on media. Though I find it especially challenging to speak on media, human rights and diversity, all these buzzwords of modernity. And basically, I should apologize beforehand that certainly in my presentation there would be new questions asked and not always answers delivered. As a journalist, someone who received training, journalist training and worked in journalism for some years before transferring to human rights, I think I would break one of the journalists' taboo, and I will start with stories, three stories of yesterday. Being someone who is basically into news approach to journalism and news delivery, certainly I shouldn't be telling you the yesterday stories if they were not that important to me and my country and the general context of our conversation. So it's 7th of October 2010, and the first story I'm going to tell, and then you'll have a chance to compare and to have your own judgment what stories, which ones of these stories would be covered in your local national press and international press. I will start with words about the sadness of this day for the Russian journalist community, because that's 4 years since the murder of Anna Politkovskaya, a very courageous person, a journalist who lost her life doing a very unpopular job, covering the situation in Northern Caucasus and human rights abuses in Northern Caucasus, Chechnya, Dagestan, over the first and the second Chechen War. And the profound difference between these two wars for Russia and for the whole world would be that the first war was basically everywhere, in the national press, in the international press, in blogs. And journalists had a lot of access to Chechnya, and they were able to cover tremendous human rights abuses happening in Chechnya at that time. Unfortunately, the Second World War, it's very unfortunate that it happened, first of all, and it was absolutely different in terms of media coverage and in terms of the press approach. First of all, because the governmental regulation changed and the general line really changed, and the actual environment was very hostile to any independent journalism. It was very dangerous to go to Chechnya. It was basically and practically not possible to go there as a journalist. You were either taken by the so-called presidential tour, where you would, of course, see nice images, and you would be somehow supervised by someone, some official, and you wouldn't be able to work independently. We finished with the new generation of journalists being basically unaware of what was happening in Chechnya for all these years, and the discourse of stabilization of the situation prevailed in the Russian and international media as well. And Anna was one of those voices that basically was giving her own voice to those voiceless in Chechnya and Northern Caucasus. And she was murdered 4 years ago. There was an investigation, but no tangible results so far. There was a trial, and the perpetrators or those people on trial were acquitted by the jury. And there's ongoing investigation that would last until at least until February 2011. Anna's name is not the only name of journalists murdered, killed over recent years in Russia. There's, in fact, 11 cases of murders of journalists since the year 2000 by the information and data gathered by Commission to Protect Journalists, CPJ. All in all, Russia rates 8th place in CPJ's impunity index. They started to put together impunity index for countries where there's no proper investigation on cases of journalists' murders and abuses against journalists. Why I'm telling this story about 7th of October is not just to make a personal tribute to Anna and courageous people. There are a few that still work in Northern Caucasus and write about human rights abuses there, but basically to give you a sense of the situation with the press in the country, because, of course, it poses important question to us all whether the press should be free to be able to work on diversity issues and to be able to cover human rights abuses and work on human rights, and whether unfree press could be a facilitator for any kind of dialogue. If it can, then certainly being unfree whose voice is this media projecting? That's a big question, and I wouldn't myself say that the press is absolutely unfree and the media is absolutely unfree in Russia. It would have been terribly wrong and terribly unfair to very many former colleagues of mine and those who are still working in the local newspapers, who are doing internet journalism and who are doing great reportages. So I would really not generalize in that case. But I would certainly quote the latest ratings by human rights NGO that works in Russia on issues of media freedom. They're called Glasnost Defense Foundation, and some of you may recall the word glasnost. It used to be a buzzword some 15, 20 years ago, and it's no longer so, unfortunately. But these guys are still working on glasnost. And they had a monitoring on 83 of regions in Russia. And what they found is that basically partially free regions are only 16 of 83. Then 44 would be partially unfree. 22 would be unfree. And there's no information on one. They were unable to give their judgment on one of the regions. So basically, this is the situation. They tend to color on their mapping, that they tend to color these regions in different colors, and free is a green. And unfortunately, there's no green spots on that map, only darker spots. So again, that's a question, how unfree press or partially free press or just few free voices would be able to facilitate any dialogue. Then the second case, the second story of yesterday, would be something which in many senses gives us hope and gives us opportunity to speak about the change which is still happening. It's also thanks to people in the media and, social media as well. I'm speaking here about the judgment of yesterday, and that's, again, a judgment of the European Court of Human Rights on the case of Alauddin Sadykov. He's a former school teacher who lived in Chechnya, and in the year 2000, he was stopped on his way to in his native city of Grozny, and he was basically delivering water to his people in the local community. He was stopped. He was taken by some security forces or law enforcement agencies into prison ward, and he was severely tortured with his ear cut off as a result of those tortures. And in cases like this, and there's so many of them, basically people tend to lose any hope. But there's justice, and that's one of the words that I was especially happy to hear yesterday in the opening panel of the conference. There is justice, and there was justice in the European Court of Human Rights. And just if we think about the scale of things and the change over this 20 years for my country, for Russia, with the opportunity now to appeal to the European Court of Human Rights, with the actual change of understanding of the law and legislation and the court system and how the judiciary work, with a flood of cases from Russia going to the European Court of Human Rights, and basically with this case of Alauddin Sadykov finally receiving judgment where the European Court of Human Rights stated Russia being guilty in not providing investigation and not providing legal remedies and not providing justice to Alauddin Sadykov, that's one of the happy moments that we share when we speak about the media and when we speak about human rights and abuses and our will and our might to change things for the better. You can guess how many news reports appeared on Sadykov so far. The coverage has been minor, but maybe it's just because of the journalists being sometimes slow and lazy and not that efficient. And, of course, I don't want to criticize my former colleagues because it's just very human and humane being lazy. And, of course, Strasbourg is a long way from Moscow and even a longer way from Grozny, from Chechnya. But it's very encouraging that this mechanism, and basically that's the only international mechanism that is effective in Russia these days in terms of human rights and bringing perpetrators to justice, that we are able to work through European court. That's a tremendous change. It hasn't been around 10 years ago and 20 years ago, and it was unthinkable even 10 years ago, to receive judgments on their cases. And here, speaking about justice and importance of justice, because European Court of Human Rights is certainly one of the areas Human Rights Watch pays particular attention and has been trying to work on for a long time and has put up several reports on cases on Chechnya. That's certainly a very long way to actual justice from the decision of European Court. And God knows how many news coverage would that receive, because so far getting the decision is just a first step in bringing actual justice to the country. Well, I decided to draw your attention to this case to highlight and to flag this issue, because it says about change, it says about justice, and it says about uncertainty, it says about the news coverage as well. And again, I tried to check with the international media, which is of tremendous help in basically profiling and making recognizable some cases of human rights abuse. It's of tremendous help to Russian media. So as an old dissident's time, as in 30 or 40 years ago, sometimes these days, you still need the international press, the big names of international journalism, to come and cover some of the stories before they appear in the local context. And, well, that's maybe just a trait of the modern journalism and the modern newsmaking. At the same time, in the context of a partially free media, that's also the way of getting the important news from the national context back to the national context, though you need to go over the globe to highlight these issues. And, of course, the third story of yesterday also related to news media and journalism. Would seem very odd to many of you, and I do apologize for bringing it, but it really shows a different angle on news freedom, news media, and how the perception of the audience changes. Yesterday was also a birthday of Russia's Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Why I'm telling this here in this audience is because the day before his birthday, a lot of news reports appeared that some of the female students of the prestigious Moscow State Faculty of Journalism put up a calendar with photographs of female journalist students in their underwear, while congratulating and sending warmest regards to Vladimir Putin and his policy and his enlightened rule. That's something absolutely, well, it may sound ridiculous, it may sound odd, and I would say that for majority of the internet audience, it really sounded that way. And, of course, that was the greatest story of yesterday and the day before yesterday, Prime Minister's birthday and this calendar. But, well, thanks God, it's never one-sided, and it's never certain. Anything in Russia is never one-sided and certain. Well, of course, a continuous process, and it's a different world. And just overnight, bloggers and a different bunch of female students from the Moscow State Faculties of Journalism created another calendar, and with girls dressed in strict black suits with their lips sealed and posing very important questions for Russia and human rights these days. One of these questions being, who was the murderer of Anna Politkovskaya? What should we do about freedom of assembly? What should we do about inflation? And basically, all these very core things that we would like to address our government with. So it's a different angle, all this story. And I would say by the press coverage, I was trying to somehow monitor and measure which of the three stories was the most popular with the media. Just guess which one was that. So these were my tales of yesterday. And just to conclude, because I would be very happy to elaborate on migration issue and the hate speech issue, I will just say that my colleagues from the Sova Monitoring Center that have been monitoring Russian press for years and have been basically measuring the hate speech content in the Russian press finding so-called anti-heroes of the Russian press. It used to be a long list 10 years ago with different ethnic groups there. But recently, and that's again, maybe that's the international trend, or we can find other reasons, other explanations to that. All these categories somehow merged into migrants. So migrants became the main anti-hero. And maybe it was due to some of the policies implemented by the state, by the government, and in their attempts to promote tolerance and by their criticism and their new legislation on mass media and hate speech. Maybe that was also due to the new anti-extremist laws that are somehow applied to media outlets as well. So journalists just stopped using ethnic categories and portraying ethnic groups in negative, offensive ways. And all these ethnic terms and groups simply merged into general migrants. And of course, that's rather adds to the problem than makes us closer to the solution of it. But it's again an ongoing debate, and I'd be happy to answer your questions about that. And just at the end, answering the main question of our session, whether the media should be provocative or facilitating, I would rather say, well, of course, both. And in the situation when the press is unfree, we do need more provocative hints and publications in the good sense of the word provocative. Speaking on diversity, I would certainly say that the only diversity I would prefer in a country where the situation with press is disturbing, where journalists are killed and there's no proper investigations of their cases, I would definitely prefer the diversity of the quality news and the quality media content. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We've just had a good suggestion from the panel that we'll continue the tour of the world first, and then we'll land back in Canada. So we're going to go next to Siddharth Varadarajan, I'm going to pronounce that sort of closely, from the Hindu newspaper in Delhi, India, and he's an award-winning journalist and also an economist who's spent a lot of his professional life both in North America and in India. Welcome.
Thank you. In keeping with the spirit of yesterday's inaugural, I'd like to begin with the story, which is quite evocative, or it conveys quite a bit about underlying problems in the Indian media. One Sunday evening, a couple of years back, an email message arrived in the inbox of crime reporters in Goa and Bangalore, two Indian cities. Two Indian regions. The message purported to be from a hitherto unknown German intelligence agency. This agency claimed credit for the arrest on the Karnataka-Goa border of a fugitive Nazi war criminal named Johann Bach, who was responsible allegedly for the killing of 12,000 Jews in the so-called Marsha Tikash Wanab concentration camp. Utter nonsense, right? The email contained a press release full of outlandish details about the operation, including the claim that the octogenarian Bach had revealed his identity to a holidaying Israeli couple during a rave party in Goa and had stolen an 18th century piano from a museum in East Berlin, which he was trying to sell through a local newspaper. The email was literally full of clues suggesting it was a hoax. The author revealed that he was hamming because it was sent by a guy called Hammond Smith. The address was given as Shady Road. And the rather un-Germanic name for this intelligence agency, Pyrrhus Narpk, was an anagram for super prank. Even if journalists did not know there was no concentration camp with the name Marsha Tikash Wanab, a quick search on the internet might have at least triggered a warning light. And yet a number of hacks and their editors rushed to print, believe it or not, with this sensational story without bothering to check any of its hilarious details. The Telegraph, which is one of India's venerable daily newspapers, broadsheets, competition of ours, but you know, it's all fair. The Telegraph ran the story. We didn't touch it. The Telegraph ran the story under the headline, Goa Piano Thief Found to be Nazi War Fugitive. The story ran on the front page. It quoted, and here you see the journalists making up stuff, huh, because we all got to see this so-called press release later, and that was the only information anybody had. So the Telegraph reporter quoted intelligence bureau officials, okay, now that's an Indian agency, saying that Mr. Bach had come to India via Argentina, Bulgaria, and Canada. Totally made up. The story was accompanied by a world map showing Mr. Bach crisscrossing the world before ending up in Goa. The word unconfirmed was inserted parenthetically next to Yemen, suggesting that the newspaper had confirmed all other parts of the story. And how was this terrible criminal caught? The newspaper provided this breathless account, and I quote, Goa's beaches are frequented by young Israeli couples, most of them seeking leisure after a term of compulsory military service in their country. Bach, mistaking the couple for Americans, told them he had managed a Nazi concentration camp during the war. The German authorities put two and two together when they realized that the museum from where the piano was stolen was located close to a concentration camp in Berlin. They already knew that the camp was run by a young man named Bach, who was never caught after the war, unquote. I have details I can share with you from how other papers, including the Indian Express and the Times of India, reported this utter nonsense of a story. The Telegraph and the Times of India put it on page one. Now, it's easy to... Now, this was a prank by a media NGO in Goa, whose aim was to expose the unprofessional nature of the local media in Goa. But they succeeded in exposing the underbelly of the national Indian media. And I, for one, wasn't too surprised by the story, because although the Johann Bach, really outlandish, it was no more so than the reports regularly put out by Indian police departments about the arrest of terrorism suspects. If you look at any newspaper, and my newspaper would also be guilty from time to time of reporting these things in that way, the Indian police, Indian intelligence agencies often make claims about arresting key terrorist suspect on the eve of a particular on national holiday or a day when everybody's expecting attacks. Typically, this guy would have been in custody for 2 or 3 weeks prior to his arrest being announced, during which time he would have been completely worked over. And his arrest would be announced on a particular day. And this is obvious to any journalist who attends a press conference that this is utter nonsense, that the police are simply taking us for a ride. But nevertheless, journalists, editors do not question when the police make these kind of claims. And what our prankster friends from Goa managed to do was to expose, was to show exactly how, where this kind of gullibility can take you when you don't bother to verify any facts. You accept whatever an intelligence agency or the police says is reality, and you just report it completely forgetting all the basic rules of your craft. So this is what happens when, unfortunately, an otherwise free and fair media loses or places such complete faith in the security establishment, especially when it comes to questions of national security. When it comes to corruption, when it comes to the shenanigans of politicians, when it comes to, you know, we've had a big problem in Delhi in organizing the Commonwealth Games. The Indian media has been at the forefront of exposing corruption, exposing, you know, various problems. But somehow when it comes to national security, it seems as if the authorities can make any claim whatsoever. And chances are that those claims will go by unchallenged. May not be all that dissimilar to Russia. But it's disconcerting because in India we have a 60 or 70 year tradition, perhaps even longer, of a media that has prided itself on its freedom. Now, over-reliance on the security establishment is a problem at the best of times. But in a society which has the kind of diversity that we do in India, this poses especially difficult or problematic. It's a special challenge because because this kind of over-reliance on the claims of the security establishment can have a lethal impact on human rights in a situation where religious minorities or people in in areas like Kashmir or the Northeast fall victim to an over-securitized or over-energetic security establishment. And I want to essentially discuss with you in my talk today present to you my assessment of where the Indian media stands in relation to I'm using the word diversity in a very loose form, but I want to look specifically at the Indian media and Muslims as the most prominent religious minority. I want to look at how the Indian media covers problems of human rights in Kashmir, which is one region in India which has, where people are protesting and are demanding azadi, what they call azadi or independence. And I also want to look at what has become another very urgent and serious problem, which is the Maoist insurgency in central India. And how the state is responding and how the media looks at this. And I think each of these three will provide us a fairly comprehensive insight into the Indian media's approach to human rights, because whether it's minorities, whether it's Kashmir, whether it's the anti-Maoist insurgency, each of these situations have given rise to the violation of rights on a fairly large scale. If I were to start with Muslims and their relationship with the Indian media, there have been periods of, there have been ups and downs. I think if you go back, if you take a long view, there have been, in the 60s or 70s, times when you could find, or even in the 80s, times when you could find, even in the national media, examples of quite extraordinary insensitivity towards minority rights. I remember in the 80s, in 1984, when Indira Gandhi, who was Prime Minister at the time, was assassinated. And she was assassinated by bodyguards who happened to be Sikh, of the Sikh religion. And that created a situation where the ruling party at the time, the Congress Party, which is today also ruling India, unleashed through its goons and foot soldiers massacres on the streets of Delhi, where as many as 5,000 innocent Sikhs were killed in a matter of 3 days, and several hundred Sikhs were killed in other North Indian cities. Wherever the Congress Party was ruling, you had a situation where for 2 or 3 days the police simply abdicated any responsibility towards protecting the life and liberty of citizens, and these mobs had a free run, resulting in very heavy casualties, very heavy the murders, mass murders of people. If you look at how the media covered those mass killings at that time, you find very little by way of, even though the reporters were on the street or human rights organizations that visited refugee camps and spoke to survivors, even though they were left in no doubt about the role of the police and the ruling party in organizing the massacre, the media was quite timid in terms of reporting these facts. And where these facts were reported, there was a tendency to leaven them with absurd justifications for this violence. So you had the editor of the Times of India at that time, Mr. Girlal Jain, reminding readers, this is just after Indira Gandhi's been shot by Sikhs and there's violence in the streets, reminding readers about how the Sikhs have been testing the patience of Hindus for so long. Really quite provocative stuff under the circumstances. And that was the Times of India, which then was Delhi's second largest paper. Today is, of course, the biggest paper in Delhi. And you had it required the publication of human rights reports 2 or 3 weeks later for the full facts to emerge. Now, that was in the 80s. I would like to believe that such a situation in terms of media silence is not possible anymore at the national level. And part of the reason why I am optimistic is because in 2002, when a similar massacre was enacted in the state of Gujarat, across the state of Gujarat, by violent mobs linked loosely to the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, and again with police support, it was the national media that actually conducted the campaign to expose the involvement of the police and the ruling party. The local media, unfortunately, the Gujarati language media, unfortunately, was quite complicit in the violence. So you had, and I published a book in 2002 on this, where you can find some of these details. I'd be happy to share the citation with you later. But the Gujarati language media was quite involved in publishing false information, in publishing provocative information, information that really was aimed at heightening tension between Hindus and Muslims, and creating a justification for attacks on Muslims. The violence in the state lasted more than a month, at the end of which nearly 2,000 innocent people were killed. But the national media, television news reporting came into its own during that time, plus the English language and Hindi language daily newspapers, did accurately report what happened. And I would like to believe that the role of the national media at that time in reporting with sensitivity what was really a genocidal attack on Muslims in Gujarat helped to put the government on the back foot and to ensure that the massacres were stopped before they got completely out of hand. And so the casualty level, even though 2,000 is completely unacceptable, it might well have been much higher had the media not, national media not played the kind of role that it did. I would like to distinguish here between a phrase that I use called low-intensity communalism and high-intensity communalism. Communalism is the word we use in India. It's a peculiar word to describe religious intolerance or, it's part of the British colonial linguistic tradition, but we see evidence of high-intensity communalism in the media at moments when violence, when communal riots or communal violence takes place. But happily, fortunately, I think today, high-intensity communalism in the media, where the media actually serves as provocateur to violence, tends to be confined to really very localized media outlets now. So in Gujarat, it was the local language press, and unfortunately, we have cable channels now that broadcast within the city, which lends a new and dangerous edge to this kind of provocative reporting. But it's confined to very local networks, which is not to say that they don't do enormous amounts of damage. Unfortunately, the way the Indian hate speech laws are structured, the sanction of the government is required before a case for hate speech can be registered under Section 153A of the Indian Penal Code. Now, given the mechanics of communal violence as it happens in different Indian cities at different points in time. These incidents of violence happen precisely because the local government wants them to happen. And the local government is what controls the police. So it's very difficult to imagine a hate speech crime being registered when the local authorities themselves are hand in glove with the engineering of this violence. So I'm not sure where legal remedies take us. We've had discussions in the Press Council of India and the Editors Guild about what to do with this kind of irresponsible press coverage during incidents of communal violence, and have not really reached any successful conclusion. But if high-intensity communalism of this kind, where journalists and newspapers and radio, and not radio, TV, help to provoke violence, is now really very much the rare exception, I think we have a continuing problem with low-intensity communalism. What do I mean by that? I mean a general insensitivity on the part of even the national media when it comes to coverage of the marginalization and discrimination of Indian Muslims. Virtually no newspaper or television channel has a communities reporter, has a reporter that is dedicated to looking at and covering as a story problems that, since we're talking about Muslims in a city like Delhi or Bombay face as Muslims. And the fact that they often tend to be discriminated or to receive a raw deal when it comes to government services, when it comes to housing, when it comes to employment. Much of this discrimination and marginalization was captured in a report produced for the Government of India 4 years ago by the Satchar Committee, which documented the fact that Muslims across India have a position that is only slightly better than the scheduled castes in terms of socioeconomic indicators, but who receive no benefits in terms of quotas, in terms of reservation that the scheduled castes and even other backward communities receive in India. All of this is known, this is well documented, but despite that, there is a general tendency in the part of the media to not report this as extensively as it ought to. These problems of discrimination in housing, for example, which is pervasive. It's very difficult for young Muslim men in Delhi to find rental accommodation, especially if you're middle class and you want to find and you have the money to pay for a flat in a slightly upscale area. It's very difficult for you to find this kind of accommodation, except in Muslim ghettos, and these things get reported only when a celebrity, like there was a case a few years ago of a Bombay film star who was unable to buy, he wanted to buy a flat, an apartment in a certain high rise block, and everything was all ready to be signed, and at the last minute, when the other owners of flats in the same complex found out that he was a Muslim, some excuse was given as to why this flat cannot be sold. And in any civilized society, that would give rise to critical commentary and perhaps a lawsuit. Here, the entire pressure was on this chap to back off. And finally, he chose not to make a big issue out of it. So there's general insensitivity about reporting these sorts of things. Another aspect of the low intensity bias in the Indian media against Muslims is the prominence given to backward or reactionary or obscurantist leaders within the community. So whenever the media wants to give a Muslim voice on a particular issue, the tendency will be to go and find the most obscurantist, most reactionary, most backward character possible and present that person as the Muslim view. There's no question asked about how representative that person may be. There's no attempt to find out or to seek out other voices that are critical, especially when it comes to women's rights, especially when it comes to lots of other things. And I think this is a very serious problem. Demands for justice, when Muslims make these demands, there's a tendency to treat these as troublesome, don't rake up the past, There was a judgment of a high court in Uttar Pradesh last week in the Ayodhya, this historic dispute over a Ram temple and a Babri masjid. This is where a mosque was demolished in 1992 by mobs having allegiance to Hindu right wing groups. And this litigation finally, which on legal grounds everybody expected the Muslims to win, because the mosque stood there for 500 years, was given to Hindu plaintiffs on the grounds that, this is the first time that a court anywhere in the world has ruled a particular coordinate as the birthplace of God. And there was enormous pressure on Muslims on TV talk shows on the day the judgment was announced, that, well, you know, this happened 10 years ago, let bygones be bygones, we should move on, the country should move on, we should compromise, we should settle. Where, of course, the settlement and the compromise means that you remain divested of your mosque. So I think that this is, again, a subtle form of kind of anti-minority views or you know, discrimination that I see in the media. My time is running out, so I'll just take 2 minutes on the last two, on the other, on Kashmir and Maoist. I can't do justice, really. But I think, you know, Kashmir is an area where the Indian media traditionally had a terrible blind spot. At a time when human rights violations were at their peak in the early 90s, mid-90s, there was a tendency for the media not to report these or not to give sufficient detail. That situation has changed. Today, you will find far more coverage of killings of innocent people by the security forces. There's even a much higher degree of empathy with the protests that we see in Srinagar today, but there is still, despite that, the same tendency, this Johann Bach tendency, to fall for whatever the intelligence agencies give you. And so there was recently, you know, there have been massive street protests in across Kashmir over the last 2 months. And everybody who's been there has said has testified to the fact that these protests are spontaneous. They really are leaderless, and that's what makes them quite subversive. And it's not as if these crowds are being manipulated by anybody, let alone by Pakistan or some outside hand. And you had the police release an audio tape of a telephone conversation, allegedly between two Kashmiri leaders, which purported to show how we are manipulating this crowd, and, you know, it's all, you know, everybody's there because we are summoning them, etc., etc. And the translation given of this Kashmiri conversation was wrong. And when Kashmiri what's changed over the last 10 years is that young Kashmiri boys and girls in Srinagar have access to the internet. And so within half an hour of TV channels playing the Intelligence Bureau translation of this conversation, you had Kashmiri activists putting out on Facebook and YouTube their translations to show how this police tape, if not a complete fabrication, really was misrepresenting what was the reality on the ground. So I think there is a tendency, as I said, for the media to fall for the security establishment's perspective. That said, there is still there are many, many examples of the Indian media rising to the occasion, exposing rights violations, though not with the same degree of tenacity and consistency that we would like to see and that perhaps a remedy would require. Just to end, I don't have time for Maoists. I'll leave it for the discussion. But just to end, the question that everybody's asking, provocateur or facilitator, if being a provocateur means to ask the right questions, I'm all for it. Unfortunately, the media has tended to be provocative in a negative way, often when it comes to questions of religious diversity. So I would much rather rather than choose between provocateur and facilitator, I would be much happier if we just concentrated on being professional. We just concentrated on being objective. We just concentrated on observing the tools of our craft, because I think in being faithful to those tools, we can make a much better contribution towards justice and human rights for all the diverse collectives that make up Indian society. Thank you.
Okay, now we've heard several different points of view and perspectives and examples on the good theme for today. I'm aware of the time. I do not wish to provoke you. I do wish to facilitate the room. And I'm aware of the time being approximately coffee break time. My original intention was to hear from all the panelists first, and so I would like to know if I have the permission of the room to proceed, and we will hear from our last speaker, and then we'll break. But then what I need from you is promise that you'll come back so we can actually have a discussion afterwards, right?
May I suggest you limit your coffee break to 15 minutes?
Yes.
I think you've got a lot of discussion.
That's right, yeah. Great. So for those who couldn't hear, that was that we're going to have a tight 15-minute coffee break. So coming back to Canada now to wrap up the panelist presentation portion with Haroon Siddiqui, who is with the Toronto Star, and he's in Toronto, but he's really bringing a perspective from 40 years of work from various countries all around the world, including a number of the countries that we've been hearing about from the other presenters. And for those of you who are not from Canada, I'll also just tell you that he's a recipient of the Order of Canada, which is our highest national prestigious award for his work and the contribution that that work has made in advocating fairness, inequality of opportunity,
enough,
and pluralistic society. So I say that because I think that a lot of times journalists are well known for how they irritate, and I think it's also it's also important that we know that sometimes they're known for important contributions they make as well.
Thank you, Marisa. Francois and Gordon wanted me to speak specifically about the media in Canada in relation to the topic at hand, pluralism, multiculturalism, diversity, human rights, and so on. I mean, obviously, it's a statement of the obvious that we have a free country and a free media, and that we are not in Rwanda where the radio station instigate people to mass murder, or like Siddharth was saying about low intensity or high intensity communalism where we are provoking people and so on. Whereas we don't have those extremes, we do have problems in this country. And one needs to be honest in dealing with them. We are free and we don't get murdered in this country like Anna did in the Soviet Union, but we do get demonized. We get blackballed. We get fired sometimes. And your dinner invitations dry up. I speak with some experience, having written what I wrote after 9/11. So a lot of dinner invitations, people who are my friends were no longer my friends. So we operate within, besides the social limitations, we have other limitations. We have the limitations of laws, for example. The first limitation is the law of libel and defamation that we all must respect and do respect. We have the laws of hate in this country, as we do across the United States, but not in Europe, not in the United States. Those laws of hate are divided into the Criminal Code of Canada for very serious cases of instigating hatred and so on, where you can end up in jail. Or the second lower category of anti-hate laws, which are human rights codes, which then are divided into the federal jurisdiction under the Federal Human Rights Commission, and then under the various provincial government commissions like the Ontario Human Rights Commission, British Columbia, and so on. This being Canada, we have many jurisdictions and many various interpretations of the law, so you don't get an equal application of the same law or different laws in this country, but that's a sort of minor point. Then there is a huge debate within that gambit as to what constitutes hate. There's a great deal of debate. And the final word on that issue has really rested with the Supreme Court of Canada, which defined hatred as saying it has to be so extreme that it ascribes no value to the group being attacked and so on and so forth. And we will not get into the details of that. Having said all of that, what I'm leading you to think about is the following. It is the elasticity of these laws, and it is in the elasticity of how we define hatred that opens the floodgates to media irresponsibility, which is what Colette's point was in the context of Belgium. We operate in the space where what is acceptable and what is not acceptable in society. Anti-Catholicism, for example, is no longer acceptable in Canada. Anti-Semitism, even though we still have incidents of it, is no longer acceptable in mainstream Canada. Being anti-gay is becoming unacceptable. Being anti-black has become, by and large, unacceptable. But being anti-Muslim and anti-Islamic remains acceptable in Canada. We have not broken any law yet, but we are operating in this gray zone as to what is acceptable in society and what is not acceptable in society. So in that, the media are really a reflection of the society in which we are operating. Anti-Arabism is quite acceptable. You can say anything you like about the Arabs and get away with it, by and large, in this country. There is one more element that is not often understood by outsiders, is the element of self-restraint. We all must exercise self-restraint. Free speech is not absolutely free, in the same way that certain rights must operate in balance with other rights. My right to swing my arm stops at a cheek, and so on and so forth. And we exercise self-restraint in the media every day. And why is it that we no longer see cartoons of, say, native people with feathers and arrows and bows in this day and age? We no longer see cartoons of hook-nosed Jews that we used to see 40 or 50 years ago. We no longer see cartoons of cross-eyed Chinese at this point. But we want to publish the Danish cartoons, and we want to go to defend them in the name of free speech. So there's an elasticity in this thing that gives you a lot of room to debate and discuss in a democracy, as we should, and lets people get on the high horse of freedom of speech and freedom of expression in the context of Danish cartoons, but these same people will be saying exactly and singing exactly different tune on the other examples that I have just given you. So in effect, what we are doing is we are operating on double standards. This again is not exclusive to the media. It's a reflection of the society we live in because our values change. Our values evolve as we get more multicultural and so on. So whereas the proponents of free speech would not dare say that it is part of my free speech that I can be anti-Catholic and anti-Semitic, the same people will argue that my freedom of speech gives me the right to do what I want to do when it comes to Muslims. I have a right to poke them in the eye. I have a right to be provocative. It's our right to insult religion. And all these debates that we hear are totally hypocritical. And they have not broken any law yet. So we are operating in this gray zone, and that's where the debate lies. And what I'm saying to you is the moral of this entire story is that, A, the debate should be about double standards. The debate should be how we define hatred. And the debate should be how we exercise our self-restraint, where we exercise self-restraint and where we do not exercise self-restraint. This is what Siddharth's point was in the context of India and the journalism that's conducted there. I'll move now to media and multiculturalism. And that really started off as a debate about the media and immigration and immigrants. You must know that in the popular culture and the popular narrative of Canada, throughout our history, the narrative about immigrants has always been irrefragably negative. They are spoiling Canada. They are doing these horrible things. They are a burden on society. they are committing crimes. They are taking too much social welfare. And we say this about every new wave of immigrants. Until they go up on the strata of society and then they become respectable, then we pick on the latest people. So we picked on the Jews at one time, we picked on the Japanese Canadians at one time, and Chinese Canadians, and Ukrainians, and Poles, and blacks, and then Somalis, and so on and so forth. We never seem to learn from our history how unoriginal we are in making these points. And the media themselves have a total amnesia. Our memory extends to yesterday. The news cycle of 24 hours. Maybe it extends to 1 week or 2 weeks or a month and not beyond that. So we are totally oblivious of our own history as to what we have said about each group of people who have arrived in this country until they became respectable, and then we start saying the same thing about the latest people who have come. The great genius of Canada, for especially those of you who have come from outside, is that our public policy has managed to stay above all of this nonsense. This is barroom wisdom in Canada. This is the small talk of Canada. When we go to a bar, this is what we talk about. But we know not to take that and translate it into public policy, unlike in Europe, where barroom wisdom is making it to public policy. I think that's the difference. In Quebec, we had one instance of it, you know, the Bouchard-Taylor Commission and so on, and all this nonsensical debate that we had. And the sensible commission and came and said what it said, and we can talk about that in the question and answer period. The only instance of that that has made it to legislation is in this wretched legislation brought forward by Mr. Charest, banning government services, including health services, to taxpayers of Quebec who happen to be wearing the veil. This is an extraordinary violation of human rights, but this is the first instance one can think of in modern times where public prejudice has made it to legislative stage. Multiculturalism was a popular event at one time because multiculturalism, for those of you who don't know, was our way of escaping this binary Canadian debate that we are a bicultural nation, bilingual and bicultural nation. And the Ukrainians and the Poles and the others said, well, how about us? We too belong to Canada. So Pierre Elliott Trudeau and the others came up with the concept of multiculturalism, saying we are all in this together. And the media at that time said, "This is a great thing. This is a very inclusive thing in Canada." That was good until the Browns and Blacks started coming in great numbers to Canada. Then multiculturalism became bad in the 1990s. You know, Max Yeldon, who was the chairman of the Canadian Human Rights Commission, said, this is garden variety chauvinism that's taking over Canada. So multiculturalism got a sort of bad name. And multiculturalism became a surrogate for attacking new immigrants, specifically brown immigrants and black immigrants. Post 9/11, multiculturalism is a surrogate for attacking Muslims and Islam. That's what's happening in Europe. We no longer want multiculturalism. This is too bad. This is all politically correct. My response to that is Europe is shedding away multiculturalism that they never had. If by multiculturalism we mean the equality of all people and all citizens. So we have this faulty discourse going on because it has a purpose to it. Because what it says is all that upheaval that's taking place in the world and the terrorism and the rise of militants within our own regions and so on, it has nothing to do with our racism. It has nothing to do with the discrimination of the Turks in Germany. It has nothing to do with the marginalization of the Maghrebin in France. It has to do with them. And it has nothing to do with the war in Iraq. It has nothing to do with the war in Afghanistan. It has nothing to do with the killing of 100,000 to a million civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan. The problem is with them. It's a way of deflecting the public discourse, including by the media, into not dealing with the real issues. How many times we were told terrorists come from the madrasas, where they're teaching them hate. I have news for you. Most of the cases in Canada, all of those who have been charged with terrorism have been the product of our public schools in Mississauga, in Toronto, in Montreal. Should we be going and bombing the public schools in Mississauga or Toronto or Montreal? It was said, oh, these are all mullahs and they're maulvis. But these are modern kids. They're coming from the cricket fields of Great Britain. They're coming from the bars of Great Britain. Because we have this disconnect perpetrated by the media that what is happening has nothing to do with our actions geopolitically. So in that, we are totally dishonest. And the last point to be made in this context is, in this post-9/11 world with so much politics of fear and deflection, and the securitization of our politics, and the sacrifice of our civil rights and human rights and so on, media have become total, absolute partners of this, especially in the United States, and less so in Canada. It's only taken, what, 8 years or 9 years for the picture to change in the United States. And you will hear from Jamil Jaffer, who is one of the lawyers from the American Civil Liberties Union, who is on one of the panels. I mean, he's a Canadian boy. And he has led this battle. It has taken them 8-9 long years until the election of Obama to overturn or at least understand and raise the consciousness of the public that all those horrible things that we used to talk about them, we have been inflicting on our own people, and we in the media have been silent partners in this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Harun. I'm going to ask for good respect of the coffee break time 15 minutes from now, and I ask you to use that time to collect your thoughts and sharpen your questions so that you can get quickly to the point and we can hear from as many people as possible. Enjoy your coffee break. Thank you.